Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. Did I sound like one of those WWF wrestling announcer people? I feel like one right now. This week, I know I say this every week, but this week has been batshit crazy in the news. So we're actually going to switch the show around this week. And the first half is going to be me talking to John Kelly, not the guy who could or could not have written the New York Times op-ed that everyone is still talking about, but actually my editor, Vanity Fair. And then after we talk about Trump and the op-ed and Bob Woodward and Jack Dorsey and Sheryl Sandberg and Congress and Kavanaugh and all of the crazy, 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 crazy shit that just happened and is still happening, the second half of the show is going to be with Nancy Jo Sales, who is a writer and reporter and author and is now the director of a new documentary called Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age, which is out on HBO next week. And she's going to talk to us about what Tinder and Hinge and all of these things, these dating, whatever the hell you want to call them, have done to society, have screwed up our teenagers and young adults and so on. I'm actually featured in the documentary. I have a very small clip where I'm interviewed and I talk about how crazy technology can be for society. But it's a fascinating documentary and a really amazing interview. So let's get to the first half of this and welcome John Kelly back to the show. Welcome, John Kelly, the author of the infamous op-ed article in the New York Times. How do you feel being out as the guy who wrote this, John?
Was it really that obvious, Nick, that I did it? I used Lodestar in our conversations on your podcast before?
You have. I went back to the archives, and I recognized that you said it forwards and backwards a few times, Russell. And it was definitely you. Okay, so let's just jump right in here. We've had some crazy weeks in the Trump administration. I may have said this before, but I truly do believe it right now that this has been probably the craziest and chaotic yet. I mean, there have been moments that have been sad and despondent, fear, around potential nuclear annihilation, families being torn apart. But when it comes to actual coverage and media and our industry, this feels like the pinnacle of everything we've seen. And you and I both worked at the New York Times for many, many years. And what I want to kind of start off with is this op-ed piece that everyone's talking about and dissecting. And I wanted to get your take on if you think this is a good idea, it was a good idea, or if it was a bad idea. There are some people I've spoken to in the journalism community, some of whom have worked at the Times before and worked there, who have said that they don't think it was a great idea, that it really kind of makes the Times look bad. It makes them look like, you know, they're involved with the deep state, if you will. And there are a lot of people who say the opposite and think that it was a rallying cry and a you know, almost like a cheerleader saying, "Hey, we're here fighting with you. Don't worry." But as someone who worked at the Times as an editor, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think first and foremost, it is massive, right? I mean, it is just. It, as John Homans here would say, it is a massive score, and it was not a gift. You know, I know that James Dow, the op-ed editor, has told Michael Barbaro on The Daily, and also I think he talked to Stelter. Our own Joe Pompeo has done a story on this. They were contacted through an intermediary that the Times was comfortable with, but they had to vet this person, he or she, very considerably, and I'm sure an extraordinary amount of time went into making sure that they weren't being catfished, making sure that they weren't falling into the trap of some sort of opposition researcher. You know, Times editors are famously skittish about these kinds of opportunities because they worry that they're being taped by someone who's, you know, who's going to put it on the internet and if they are to ask for incriminating evidence about Donald Trump or do anything that could suggest a liberal agenda. So I think that they did an extraordinary job of bringing in a humongous fish. And I think that they vetted this person well. I'm sure a lot of careful thought went into the precise language. Lodestar is a word that we've all stopped on.
The internet is picking it apart, Oxford comma by Oxford comma by M dash. Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, I don't think that anyone's going to figure it out by that stuff. I think if you have the guts to write this, you are... you're in the clear.
This person wants to be discovered at some point, right? I mean, I presume that the tenure for the average Trump administration official, it's like the average tenure of an NFL left tackle, right? It's not a very long run in a job. So presumably, this person will have their own kind of deep throat reveal at some point in which they can bask in some refracted glow of glory and you know, valuing country over party.
I saw a funny tweet from Jestwick. It said, I'm no HR professional, but it's probably a bad sign when an employee writes an anonymous letter calling you a brain-dead asshole and you can't even narrow it down to 100 people. That pretty much well, let's talk a little bit about what is actually going on inside the White House. We've been reporting it. Axios had a great story that Trump apparently said that there are snakes everywhere. What I'm curious about is this op-ed came out on the juxtaposition of Bob Woodward's book, which is another fascinating media story where you have Trump clearly lying to Bob Woodward, who brought down Nixon, about being able to letting Bob interview him. And this book that's going to come out that apparently is going to be a bombshell. What is some of the stuff that we're hearing kind of in the newsroom and from Joe Pompeo and people like that and Gabe Sherman about what's going on inside the White House right now?
Well, we knew the book was going to be massive. I mean, I think you and I started talking about that a few weeks ago. I heard from somebody who's in great gossip loops that it was going to be an order of magnitude larger than the Michael Wolff book. Not just because Woodward's reputation is a little more pristine, establishment friendly.
A lot more pristine.
Yeah, he's pretty unimpeachable. I think that in the end, the Trump administration had very little that they could kind of back Michael Wolff down about. But Bob Woodward is his own entity. You know, everyone is seizing on this being about whether there are any Mueller clues here. It seems like Jared and Ivanka are very relatively untouched. You know what I've been hearing, and you know Gabe's reported this too, is that everyone in the inner circle of Trump world just wants to know how they came out. You know, and I think that many of them view this as their shot at posterity. Others of them view this as a way of reasserting their position in the totem, you know, within Trump world. But, you know, I think the thing that actually has mattered the most in what's been a very chaotic news cycle is not the disclosures in the book themselves, you know, not even the bit about Gary Cohn taking the NAFTA document off Trump's desk, which is, or the North Korea trade deal document off Trump's desk, which is pretty chilling. But the phone call between Trump and Woodward, I think that...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That scared the shit out of people because, you know, Americans got to hear how even in like the middle of the afternoon during prime daylight hours, Trump just sounds batshit crazy. He just sounds like someone who does not have his marbles.
The thing is, he sounds batshit crazy, but he sounds like a batshit crazy person who has an incredible memory. You know, I mean, he literally remembers. He's like, we met. You know, Bob Woodward was like, oh, yeah, it was a year and a half ago. But Trump's like, no, it's 2 years ago. And we met 20 years ago. And I mean, sure, I would remember that I met Bob Woodward, but I met Carl Bernstein once. I don't remember when it was. It's like he's half batshit crazy and he's still clearly like half quite smart in some regards, you know, his ability to remember things and numbers and so on, even though he lies about numbers a lot. But I think that the I guess the thing that I'm wondering, and I, you know, the book comes out next week and we'll know more then, but the thing that I'm wondering is if this book can have an impact. I mean, the thing what's his face's book, with Wolf's book, was that Steve Bannon was kicked out of the White House, essentially. Right. And he was kicked out of the administration, and heads rolled, and we now have a kind of a new administration, partially as a result of that. Kellyanne Conway, of course, survived. But what are the potential things that could come of Bob Woodward's book? And, you know, Bob Woodward was the guy who took down Nixon. So, you know, he's written a book about every single president since Nixon. And those books have had massive impacts. I'm curious what you think may happen as a result of this.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, comparing it to Fire and Fury is funny because that was sort of the end of the first wave of Trumpers, the ones who'd gotten him through the election and the first wave of cabinet appointees, you know. And now it's a very different cast of players. And also, there are a lot of empty jobs still. I think that most people assume that John Kelly, who either cooperated or seemed to, you know, was the boss of Rob Porter, who certainly seemed to have privileged information that's wound up in the book. Kelly's timeline has probably been expedited, is one guess. Will Trump get furious at Kellyanne Conway for not being entirely forthcoming about this? And on that call, it's pretty clear that Kellyanne Conway was the source. She went to Woodward's house for lunch, I believe. And, you know, and of course, Conway is well known to be a media leader.
Let me just interrupt for people who don't know about the call very quickly. Bob Woodward called Trump this week, and he recorded the call, and Trump said it was okay, which was also very curious. And then Trump pretended that he had never been asked to be interviewed for the book, and it was very clear. It was kind of a bit of an act, at least to me. So sorry, go on. You were saying,
yeah, and then he conceded pretty quickly that Lindsey Graham had mentioned it, and then yeah. Kellyanne Conway happened to be in his office, and Woodward asked her, and she said, oh yeah, I told Rod Shaw, you know, who's a spokesperson in the communication shop, and Trump basically said, oh Rod, I never talked to that guy. So I think Rod Shaw is also gone, although that has been reported in the past. I think Jackie Almaney, now the Washington Post, reported that Sarah Sanders and Raj were probably gone at the end of the year. But it could be significant. I mean, what I wonder is whether, and I'm just speculating, you know, but people in Trump world have generally viewed both Haley and Pence's circles as being politically motivated, very politically shrewd, and as being two people who hope to have political afterlives beyond the Trump administration. And I wonder if whether or not they cooperated, and I have no idea. There's no reason to believe that they did, but whether they are held with a certain amount of suspicion. Also, certainly, it seems like Jim Mattis is vulnerable to some emotional reprisal. It stretches out pretty significantly. I mean, you know, who's going to be unscathed? Wilbur Ross, I guess. Kudlow, Pence himself, who seems to have been very buttoned up. But what it's gonna do in the near term is just drive Trump nuts, literally. Nuts, and it seems like it's already doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was a five-alarm breakdown this week on Twitter for Trump. He tweeted the word treason ? After
I know.
The Times piece. He's been retweeting. He gave an interview to the Daily Caller of all places, saying that Bob Woodward has made the whole thing up, and he retweeted every single cabinet member that he could, and from Mattis to Kelly to you name it, to Sanders, quotes about them saying the book is fabricated. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, I mean, the thing that is just so fascinating is you hear it's as if Trump lives in his own different multiple universes, because you hear him on the phone with Bob Woodward, and Trump's praising him and saying, you know, he's the best, and they've known each other for years, and he's always, you know, blah, 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 and just like how he's the real deal. And then he hangs up the phone and starts tweeting that Woodward's a crazy person who just made a whole bunch of shit up and don't believe a word of him that he's ever said. And he literally tweeted the quote from John Kelly that this was, quote, total BS. I can't believe the president of the United States is tweeting that. But it's just fascinating how he just is a ferocious liar who just doesn't stop lying and only says what people want to hear that are right in front of him. I don't know. I mean, we will see. I will be able to talk about this next week when the book comes out. I will be reading it voraciously, and so we'll see from there.
I do think before we move on to the next topic, I do think that one interesting thing that we can return to next week is you know, Woodward books they're also different from most nonfiction in that they're cultural moments, you know. So this is a part of the zeitgeist. It's not something that is going to just, you know, appeal to right or left or to a certain intellectual demographic. It becomes its own, you know, 60 minute segment and multiple news cycles, and it becomes something that becomes part of pop culture that descends down the food chain. So I think that things like that create vulnerabilities for Trump, whereas the Mueller investigation and the Russia probe are less bothersome to his base, which is largely impervious to them. So this could have a real political setback, and I would be curious to see if it does anything to offset or delay the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation. Although I don't think it will.
I don't think it will. Well, let's just jump into the Kavanaugh conversation very briefly. I think he will end up being a Supreme Court justice. I think that he is. I think he's a very good actor. He's very good at
unbelievably
pretending. Yeah, I mean it's pretty impressive, actually. I mean, we've seen people up there in front of Congress and being questioned by committees, and they don't do well under that pressure. It's difficult. I wouldn't be able to do it. And Kavanaugh is just smooth sailing. Like, all right, let's do this. It's cameras, lights, action.
Before we started taping, we were talking. We were just bullshitting, and I was watching Kavanaugh on CNN during the hearing. I mean, my God. Has this guy mastered the like Washington faux seer? I mean, it's a stunt so good that you need like a Mark Leibovich to write about it. He looks, you know, so thoughtful, taking notes as each senator speaks. His arms are always crossed. He's always offering a sort of puppy dog quizzical look. This kind of faux serious zeal. It's this uber earnestness that people in Washington compete on, and it's just dreadful. It's why I could not last a single, you know, more than a week there without needing a lobotomy
in the swamp. Well, yeah, it's what's frustrating is how we've gone through all these news cycles around this, and the Republicans have done what the Republicans do so well, just hide documentation and not release information. And, you know, there's, of course, things that have leaked finally about how Kavanaugh doesn't consider Roe versus Wade set in stone as a law of the land. And there are all these things that have come out. But at the end of the day, you know, he will be the nominee. And I think that the only thing we can pray and hope for is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg eats her greens and does her push-ups and survives the next 2.5 years. But other than that, I think we're just screwed. It's like it's just done.
It would seem hard to imagine that the Democrats, particularly in a Democrat-led House, would be able to and with close to a. You know, I mean, let's see what happens in the Senate. It'll be close. Wouldn't find ways to to create a moratorium for a potential third Trump Supreme Court appointment. You know, mm-hmm. that would be there are political options at their disposal to stall. And
what are those political options?
Well, it's funny. I was going to say I don't have them at my fingertips, but there are political filibusters that they can use, and they can be as simple and as mercenary as what Mitch McConnell did, which was basically come up with a sort of erroneous argument with Merrick Garland that you can't do this in with an outgoing president at the start of an election year or in the middle of an election cycle, and we're getting so close after 2018. We're going to be getting so close to what will almost certainly be the most divisive, vulgar, fight to the death presidential race in our history that you could see a Chuck Schumer or a cabal of influential Congress people, maybe who have ambitions for higher office, making a sort of public relations statement. And I'm sure there are other legislative maneuvers.
I think that the reality is looking, I've questioned, I don't want to be the one that says, oh, we're going to win and the Democrats are going to win in 2018. It looks likely, but I think that everything really hinges on that.
And that would also be off-brand with your generally pessimistic viewpoint.
Well, I was just about to say that I actually this week have had an optimist. I can't even say the word. I had an optimistic moment this week. I watched the John McCain funeral and you get the feeling, even though George Bush was an asshole and a bad president and did terrible things, and even though Obama did stuff that I grossly disagree with, and I don't think he was as great a president as everyone says he was, and even though Clinton had his infidelities and it was his choices that led us to have the prison system that we have today, and so on and so forth, you get the feeling that there's another side to all of this. Where there's that we'll get through it, that we'll get that we, America will be beaten and bruised as a country. But the thing that I think that I felt after McCain was that there's this vulgar human being in the White House who is surrounded by other vulgar human beings that, refuses to go to this funeral and to say anything nice and so on and so forth. And yet you have the majority of the country that does and that supports him and former presidents that do and say, and I watched that funeral and then I went to a baseball game with my son for the first time, and I don't know much about baseball, but there was this feeling that I had where I felt America can get through this. They can survive Trump and this nastiness, and I think that there's a positive side to Trump. There's actually a hugely, hugely positive side to Trump, which is that if you want to do good in the world, you have to have an enemy to fight. And there is no better enemy than the Trump administration that has done so much bad to this country. And I think that you're seeing Beto O'Rourke and people like that who I've been talking about for the last year as a person who is able to rise above all this crap. And you're seeing this excitement around people who, and conversations, I think, where there's hope. I hate to use that word, but it's a real, that's the feeling I've had. And so I feel like there's, if it wasn't for Trump, we would not have had the Me Too movement. If it wasn't for Trump, we would not have more women running for office than we've ever had in history. If it wasn't for Trump, you wouldn't have had Cortez won. You won't have Beto O'Rourke, who's up against Ted Cruz. You wouldn't have all of these people who are able to rise through the norm and kind of offer this potential new world of government. And I think that and if it wasn't for Trump, we probably wouldn't have jobs in the way we do. I think that the media industry is doing so well because of him, because it's something that's fighting against him. And I think that this week I had this kind of positive moment thinking about all that.
Yeah, that's That takes the bright side, Nick. I'm proud of you, buddy. That's a really that's a really grown-up perspective.
Thanks.
Many people have been you're right, and many people have been certainly wounded along the way when it comes to things like the so-called Muslim ban and of course the horrific border separations which we're still getting to the bottom of.
That is true. That is true.
Many people have gotten just even wildly richer, like all the rich people that we know. And it's all gross, but if this New York Times op-ed teaches us anything, it's that the people inside the system are doing everything they can to like jank up the wheel to make sure that he can't drive the bus. So
all right, so let's end this us blabbering away on a topic I know all too well, technology. We had Jack Dorsey and Sheryl Sandberg in front of Congress this week doing more theater, and it was I felt like a lot of the stuff has been theater. It's just been there for senators to ask questions about whether. Whether they're being shadow banned or whatnot, or ask why their printer doesn't work, things like that. But I felt like this week there was kind of there's going to be a push towards some sort of I don't know if it's going to be regulation or agreement or something, but I feel like just the language that was being spoken this week meant that there was going to be. There was going to be something that will come of this stuff. And maybe there's a world where the government actually steps up the plate and does something to try to avoid what's happened before to happen again with these social media networks. I don't know.
Don't bother asking me. I don't know. Elaborate. What do you think is really going to happen? How much can really change? Given how formed they are and their role in the social firmament.
Well, I think that what can change is that there can be specific rules put in place. I think that there's a saying in business that when it comes to technology that there are two kinds of companies: those that have been hacked and those that don't know they've been hacked yet. And I think that that's true. For these social media networks, there are these. They've not taken privacy seriously. They've used it for ads. They haven't taken data seriously. Jack Dorsey can get up there until he's blue in the face and talk about how he could do better with this and better with that and do better with this and he's sorry about this and eventually they have to start doing these things and he can Dorsey talked this week about how it's dismaying to him to see that the platform has been used so negatively, and he actually said something that was complete opposite to something I've said before, which is that he thinks that by making the platform healthier, by making Twitter healthier, that more people will use it. I think that ship has already sailed, honestly. I don't think that you're going to do anything that's going to turn that around. I think that it is a de facto part of the DNA that it is a negative platform.
My question to you is it seems like the only thing that could really make this work is if there was a real business incentive, and not regulation, not like you guys got to follow the rules or else, but actually there's a company that is following the rules and becoming wildly popular. So you've got to come up with the way that Facebook copied Instagram stories. Like, is there a version of that for like civil, non-hackable, non-Macedonian troll social media? And do you think there's a business big enough to make these companies really care about the sanitization required?
I think that Mark Zuckerberg's stock fell $120 billion in 1 hour last quarter. Twitter stock has been on a precipitous decline. It's back to where it was a year ago, give or take. And I think that that is a result of consumers who have had enough, and I think that when consumers have had enough, that means that Wall Street has to follow suit, and they recognize, the great thing about these companies is there's data to prove what's really happening, and you're seeing people leave these platforms. You're seeing daily users are down on Twitter. You're seeing millions of people stop using Facebook, deleting their accounts. And that is all a result of the world that we live in today. I don't use Twitter that much anymore because it just makes me sad. It just is a gross place. And I'm not the only person who does that. I don't know. Do you use Facebook? I don't use Facebook.
I mean, the only one I actually use is Instagram, honestly, to like look at my friends, pretend they have great lives.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's all fake. It's all bullshit.
It's garbage everywhere else. Yeah, that's garbage too.
Yeah, it's all garbage. And I think that you can only watch so much reality TV, and then you're just like, oh God, this makes me feel sick. And I think
I think that's
where we are with social media. Honestly, there will be a lot of people that will still use it who have empty, vapid lives, and there will be a lot of people who use it who are normal human beings who are happy but still like to share the things that they do. But I think that a lot of people will stop and are stopping, and I think that that is the turning point when these companies realize they have no choice but to fix it. And then, on the heels of that, while all of these hearings are theater and they're there just to make the Congress people look good because they're asking tough or stupid questions, I do think that there will be some repercussions. I think, you know, Jeff Sessions is meeting with state level attorney generals to make sure that social media is not, you know, banning conservative voices. That will work in all ways, whether anything happens with it. You know, Congress is talking about legislation that will ensure that rogue governments can't do things on the platforms. And I think that we're in for a change. Whether they work out well or not, at least we're seeing something different change. So that's my positive spin on that one. See, look how positive I am today, John. This is very exciting.
You're in a great mood. I'm so happy for you, Nick.
Thank you very much.
I think you're right. It can't get worse, right? So
yes, it cannot get worse. That is the motto of today. That is the best we can do for a positive spin. On that note, I am going to end our fascinating conversation, and we're going to move on to Nancy Jo Sales, who has written for our magazine, has a new documentary out on HBO about hookup culture and technology and how that's destroying the lives of young people who are trying to find true love, like you and I, John.
I know. Well, I can't wait to hear this conversation, Nick. I'm excited to hear you talk to Nancy Jo, and I can't wait to see this documentary.
All right. Well, let's go. Let's do it. Good talking to you, John, as always. All right. Nancy, welcome to Inside the Hive.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you. So, okay, so let's just, for viewers, listeners, all those people with ears and eyes and mouths and so on, can you give us a little preview of exactly what this documentary is about?
Swiped is a kind of survey of online dating and dating apps, and it examines the ways in which technology has changed the landscape of dating and how it affects the ways that people treat each other, how they meet, how they, as evolutionary psychologists and biologists say, mate. And we talked to six main characters all over the country in four different cities, as well as a lot of experts, including you, and the heads of some of the leading dating apps, CEOs and CSOs of the big ones like Tinder and Bumble and Hinge and Match Group. And there's a lot of discussion of gender issues. We go into a lot of things, including racism on the apps, transphobia on the apps, LGBTQ, issues and concerns, and we tried to be very diverse. We talked to a lot of different people from different places, people of color, and I wanted to give a really broad range of voices because so many people use this technology.
Well, okay, so let's just go back to how this all started. So you did an article for, I believe it was Vanity Fair, about Tinder and Sean Rad, which was one of those seminal articles that get shared all over the internet because there's so much chaotic, insane stuff in it. Tell us a little bit about that. I don't remember. What was the amazing quote from Sean Rad, the CEO of Tinder? It was something about he'd screwed something up royally. But tell us a little bit about how that came about and how you got to this, and then I want to really get into, you know, how dating culture has changed since we were kids, of course, and kind of what the implications are of that. But let's go back to that article in Vanity Fair. I believe it was 2015, right? And how that all came about.
How the article came about, you mean?
Yeah, how the article came about and how this led you down this path of kind of writing more about this kind of dating apocalypse world that we live in and all the things that will come about it.
Okay, well, I did a book that came out in 2016 called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. And that all started from a Vanity Fair article, too, called Friends Without Benefits. The first anecdote in that piece was actually a 16-year-old girl in Los Angeles telling me about Tinder and how she had had her heart broken by a guy in school. And so she said she was just going to go and find some guy on Tinder and lose her virginity as a way to sort of deal with her emotions, you know, the emotional fallout of this thing. I'd never heard of Tinder before. I'd heard of Grindr. I didn't know that there were dating apps like Tinder yet. And it really had just came out. And it's, you know, it's not surprising that the first person to tell me about it was a teenager, because as you know, young people are often the first to adapt new technology. So after that, I started doing the book, and I wanted to do a film, and I was taking along a cameraman with me. I'd never been to film school or anything, so we were traveling around all these cities, and I would just take along this great cameraman that I got very lucky to be introduced to, named Daniel Carter, who's the cameraman on also Swipe, the documentary. And I, you know, Dana Brown, who's my editor at who was my editor at Vanity Fair under Graydon Carter, he said, why don't you talk to Graydon about what you're doing? If you're making a documentary film, you know, maybe he can give you some advice, whatever. So I mentioned to Graydon that I was doing this, you know, trying to make a film about, then I thought, you know, girls and social media and all these really powerful interviews I was having with all these girls about cyberbullying, slut shaming. I mean, just all of these really unprecedented things that were happening to girls online, and were, you know, this kind of sexism that was spilling onto their lives in school, so as well. And Graydon was interested, and he said, you know, why don't you do some cuts and take them up to HBO, talk to Sheila Nevins at HBO, and see what she thinks. And so I met with Sheila, then the head of documentary there, and Jackie Glover, who's one of the executive producers on Swiped. And, you know, we had several talks, and we were trying to sort of figure out how to fashion this into a movie that would work.
And are you, when you're talking about this stuff, are you talking about, like, okay, for me, when I talk about this stuff, I feel like I'm an alien from another planet. I've come down, and there's these things called teenagers that are using these apps. Are you kind of trying to understand the lay of the land in the same way most people who were not born after 1990 or whatever are? Or are you, what is it that you're trying to get to? Because the thing that's so fascinating is how quickly this culture has changed. It's really just a matter of years, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, teenagers and youth culture have sort of been my unofficial beat for going on more than 20 years. I got really lucky when I was back at New York Magazine in the 90s. I just, you know, randomly got assigned a story about teenagers, and it sort of took off from there. And I guess I've sort of become known as someone who interviews teenagers, and I do get that a lot, like, do you feel like an alien? Do they look at you like you're weird? I don't know. I don't know if it's because I'm immature or what. Right now I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt, so I don't know. I'm 53 years old, but I feel really comfortable around teenagers, and I love talking to them because I think that they have just, you know, also a lot of the stories that I write are very dialogue-driven. I see a lot of times the stories that I'm doing is almost like movie scripts, you know, like they're just like, I want to set the scene. And teenagers just talk in this great way, you know. The use of language is so alive. And I love to hear them talk about things. And even back in the 90s, teenagers were adopting new technology, and often it was used in ways that involved sex, too. Like, they were running around with video cameras, back those handheld things in the 90s, filming each other, fighting and having sex and all these things, you know, like that was the first of the sex tapes, like Pamela Anderson's sex tapes. It was like this huge deal. I mean, now it just looks so, it looks so benign because she and Tommy Lee were like madly in love and their sex tape got released, their honeymoon and everything. And it was this big scandal. Now it's like, that's just nothing compared to what the average teenager is seeing online. They were also looking at pornography. So I was sort of writing about teenagers and technology without kind of knowing it before social media as well. And so it just became like my thing. And so how did it come to be this Tinder and the dawn of the dating apocalypse story? You know, I don't write the headlines. A lot of people had this very strong reaction to this headline. Dana Brown wrote the headline, and I'm bad at headlines. It was a great headline because it got people to read the story and talk about the story, but maybe not read far enough into the story, because a lot of people took that headline, that phrase, dating apocalypse, which was actually a quote. It was in quotes in the headline, and it was a quote from a young woman who was interviewed in the piece, and she was talking about how this whole dating scene was just a mess her estimation. So Graydon assigned that story. Graydon assigned that story because, I'm sorry, this is sort of circuitous way I'm telling this, but so we're talking about doing this documentary. We're trying to figure out what it is. I'm telling him about all the reporting for my book, American Girls. I tell him about Tinder. This is Graydon. And he says, oh my gosh, I remember I took it out in his office. I didn't have it on my phone. I downloaded it and I showed him in the Vanity Fair office how quickly you could get like guys to match with you and ask you to like come over and have sex with them, like right there in the office. And he'd never seen this before. And he's like, wow, you should do a story on this. And I was actually a little reluctant at first because I said, oh, wow, it's 2015. Everybody already knows about Tinder already. But what really hadn't been discussed and what people really weren't talking about yet was the way in which these dating apps were the seat of a lot of dysfunction, and especially as involves misogyny and sexism and sexual harassment. And this just wasn't being talked about. You know, a lot of the media pieces you would see about Tinder, except for years in the New York Times, that one was notably different. But a lot of these pieces were almost read like PR for Tinder. And I don't know why that is, but because I think there was just this lovey-dovey relationship between.
Well, I don't think people, I think one of the problems was that people didn't necessarily, and I think a lot of people still don't, but a lot of people didn't necessarily see the negatives that would come from this culture. So getting to the documentary, so you sat down with all these teens. What are some of the things that you discovered from these teens that you hadn't discovered before?
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The documentary isn't really just teens. It's people who are 18 to 29. And the reason for that was that the reason it skews younger is that those are the people who mostly use dating apps. It's 18 to 25 is the largest demographic. And for a lot of them, they have never known anything else. They've never known any other kind of dating. And this goes back not even before dating apps. They were dating off of the internet, off of social media, off of different platforms, you know, texting and all this kind of thing. So technology is a part of their dating world. So it goes into characters who are on a college campus in their mid-20s and late and early 20s, mid-20s, late 20s. And we have all these different groups.
And so when you're talking to these people, so just to back up for one second, so I have neighbors that have, you know, teenage kids, and they are using these services, which is terrifying when I think about just how the culture, how quickly it's changed and what it must be like to grow up with this stuff. The thing that I keep wondering is, it's very clear, and maybe you disagree with me on this, but it's very clear that these technologies are having detrimental effects to the way kids are meeting significant others and so on. I know it's, you know, you're younger, you're in your teens or your 20s or whatever, and you're not trying to marry this person, but it's creating a dynamic that is different. Do you believe that it's bad, or do you believe that at the end of the day it's just the natural progression of how people meet each other through technology?
I think we have to look at the different things that are different. And it is, you know, we have experts in the film who are research scientists, evolutionary psychologists, who talk about the unprecedented nature of all of this. You know, I think you and I, when we had our interview for the piece, for the film Swiped, you talked about how, you know, if you criticize anything about technology at all, or even ask for an examination of what's going on, often there's this reactive thing where people say, you're a Luddite, you just don't get it, you know, you're behind the times. But I think that's really unfortunate, especially when it comes to young people and love and sex, because these are things that go to the heart of who we are and how we feel on a daily basis and how we feel in terms of whether we're being treated right or respected, you know. And so I think that what the film Swiped really, which, by the way, everyone, is Monday, September 10th at 10 p.m. I'm getting a note from the publicist here to say that. She sent me
a note. Don't worry, we'll plug it.
She sent me
we'll plug it.
She sent me this piece of paper across the table. Yes, where was I? So I think that what it really tries to do is to examine and discuss and look at it from different angles that involve not only how the people who are using it are reporting how, you know, what it's like, but also people who are experts in many fields. And, you know, just going back to how the film came about. So and this relates to what you're asking. So the Tinder and the dating apocalypse piece went viral. There's this huge controversy. I was so perplexed by that because a lot of it was as if people had never actually read the piece. I think that they latched onto this thing, dating apocalypse, and they said, oh, well, that's not true. She doesn't know what she's talking about. I went on a date last night. You know, it was just like stupid stuff like that. And really, if they had actually read past the headline of the first few paragraphs, they would see very, very, very quickly that it was about misogyny. You know, in the very first scene, which is this guy who's this really, you know, he uses Tinder very successfully, and his friends are sort of, you know, talking about all his exploits. And he says to me, because he's just looking at me listening, and I'm trying not to convey anything with my face, and he says to me, do you think this culture is misogynistic? And that's like in the very first scene of the story. And I would say that that's the question that we continue to ask in this film. And I think we should continue to ask as we look at, you know, look at how we use these things. That's one of the things. But going back to your question, is it bad? Is it good? I think, you know, the first thing about technology is speed. Everything speeds up and goes much, much faster. And, you know, you had this great quote when we did this interview way back when, and you said, and it's not in the film, sorry. You have other great quotes in the film, but you said, you said, you know, look at what technology does. You know, cars make you go faster. Airplanes make you go faster. Technology is always about speeding up life in some way. And that's certainly true in the case of Tinder and other dating apps. I mean, the whole point of them is to create the shortest space possible between you and another person so that you can start messaging each other and perhaps meet up and perhaps do other things. So is that bad or good? Well, we certainly know that it changes things. And we know that from behind a screen, you know, people are less likely to be real to, and this is borne out in like surveys of people who use these apps. They're less likely to be totally honest. They are more likely to be aggressive. You know, this is something that is widely, widely reported by me and others, and also is in the film, is the amount of sexual harassment. I was just talking to a young woman this morning from another, media venue, and she was talking to me about her Tinder use and how she's noticed, she says, I'm quoting her, that there's been more and more and more sexual harassment on these apps, that these dating apps. And she said, why do you think that is? Now, I have not reported that. That was her reporting this to me. But if that's true, if it has gotten worse, I would say it's because it's become so normalized. You know, it's like, because nobody is really asking these questions that I hope this film is asking and raising, that we start talking about more. Harassment is normalized. It's just like a kind of thing that happens on whatever dating app, you know? That's just what you come to expect. Dick pics, you know, are a thing that I think there's one study that says like 70-something percent of millennial women have received a dick pic, you know, unsolicited.
Yeah, I'm sure that number is actually probably low.
Right.
All right. So what is that?
What is that doing to us?
Well, that's what my question is. So the larger question is what are the implications of this? I mean, you sat, you talk to the CEOs of all these companies, you speak to these people that use these services, you speak to these psychologists. What are the larger implications of this? Is this just the new normal? I mean, I have a belief that when it comes to social media, for example, that we as a society are receding from it because it is not what we like and what we thought it was going to be. And people are, as you know, people have been deleting their Facebook accounts and stopped using Twitter as much and Instagram and other things like that. And while there will still be a lot of millions and millions of people that use it, there will be millions of people that do not. And I guess is this Tinder culture here to stay, or is it something that we could turn around and be like, hey, maybe we should start going to bars again and restaurants or whatever it is and start meeting people that way?
Well, the dating industry has exploded in the last 5 years since Tinder. The online dating industry has exploded. There are now thousands of these platforms, not just in America, but all over the world. There are hundreds of millions of people using them. And, you know, Tinder we keep bringing up Tinder, but you got to remember there's just a slew of other ones. But Tinder is the place that's used the most is London. And then it's New York and then Paris and then, you know, Buenos Aires and Moscow are not far behind. I mean, it's everywhere. It's in 128 countries. And other countries like China has a huge dating app culture as well. And I'm embarrassed. I can't remember the name of their big dating app. There's like a Chinese sort of Tinder. And so, you know, I don't see it slowing down. You know, Adam Alter, who's author of a great book, Irresistible, he talks about gamification and the addictive nature of the swiping mechanism, which Jonathan Bedeen, at CSO of Tinder, who we interviewed, talks very openly about creating the swipe in such a way so that it would basically be addictive, you know? So I don't think that something that's addictive, designed to be addictive and designed so well, I mean, wherever you come down on whether Tinder's good or bad, you got to admit it's kind of a genius.
Oh, yeah, no, completely.
It's kind of a genius thing. So we have something that's incredibly addictive, and it is, you know, please watch the film for a more nuanced discussion of why that is. I find it really interesting. One of the most interesting things in the film for me was the whole gamification aspect of these apps, which I learned about when I was doing it. But so it's addictive, you get sex, and it's easy. So you can get sex. That's kind of the point of a lot of people would say of it, although the heads of the dating apps argue that it's all about love and marriage and getting people, you know, riding off into the sunset and wedded bliss. But we haven't really seen, as far as Tinder goes, the data on that. I asked the Jessica Carbino, sociologist at Tinder, in the film. It's a, I think, striking moment in the film when I ask her, like, okay, well, where's your data? And she says, well, that's not available. And then we're talking about the question of whether or not people actually do get married. She says, well, we're inundated with emails, people getting married, but it's impossible to do this survey. Well, your data company, it doesn't seem impossible to me. But, you know, that's for the viewers to decide when they watch all of these exchanges, which I think are pretty interesting. But I don't see it slowing down. I don't see why would it slow down at this point, you know? And I think that it's already it's already transforming. There's now, one of my friends told me that there's now, it was described to me as a gay dating app called Taimi, I think it is, T-A-I-M-I, which now has a video capability. And I was told when I interviewed the heads of these dating companies that that's the next thing on the horizon. That's, I think the head of Match Group, Mandy Ginsberg, told me that that's not coming this year. Is, and I think Tinder said as well, this video capability where people are going to be able to, you know, stream each other live instead of just like write messages. I think the messages and the pictures are very soon going to look like the Flintstones, and that's just going to be gone. And people
that
are
sounds
gonna...
that sounds pretty it sounds pretty intense. I mean, I we all thought that when the FaceTime technology came out that we would no longer use phone calls and that that's how we would communicate. But there, it's a very personal experience to stream video to someone. It seems like it's going to kind of, you know, talking about the speed thing, it's going to speed things up even more. When I go to the, when I think about all
can
the
I
CEOs
just say
and
one
CSOs,
last thing? Can I just say the yeah. one last thing on that, which is that when I've, it's not in the, this is not in the film, but I continue this reporting. It's like just part of what I sort of do these days is when I talk to young people that I interview about, like, what do you think is going to happen when the video comes? And every single person has says, well, it's just going to be like naked, you know. I mean, like, that's already how a lot of young people, you know, FaceTime is, like, you could say for a lot of people in this culture is naked time, you know. And that's how a lot of flirting goes on now. And there's a lot of, like, sexting. A young man talks about in the film, like, how he and his friends even in middle school were Skyping and you know, sexting through Skyping and stuff. So I think it's gonna just develop along these lines and not go away.
Fun, exciting, scary. It's scary for someone who has kids. I can't imagine what it's going to look like when they're teenagers and whatnot.
Well, I'm hoping your when they're old enough, or hope you as the dad, I hope at some point you get a chance to watch the whole film, because I think that the film really is asking us to take a pause and think about what this all means and how this is, what kind of people are going to, are we going to be and what kind of people we are when we do things like ghost each other and all of these sort of really unkind and unpleasant and dysfunctional things that happen through the dating culture via technology, which have become normalized, which aren't kind or respectful and are causing a lot of people to feel bad. And the things that you don't hear about when you read these, you know, sort of like New York Times articles about, isn't it so great that, like, everybody's getting married off Tinder? That there was that very piece came out a year or two ago. And it just, as a person who was studying this culture and, you know, looking at it really closely, I just thought, like, that read like a piece of PR that was just sent down from Tinder.
Well, most technology stories do read like pieces of PR when you actually know how the sausage is made, sadly. When you talk to these CEOs of these companies, you know, the Match Group and Hinge and, you know, places like that, do they feel any... I mean, when you speak to some CEOs of tech companies, there are some, few and far between, but there are still some that feel remorse. And definitely when you speak to engineers that work for, that used to work at Twitter and Facebook, they think, oh my God, what have I done? You know, Trump is in office, the Russia influences our elections and so on. And they feel bad for the culture that they have helped create. Do the CEOs or any of the people you speak to at these companies, whether they're in the film or not, just a question, do they ever feel remorse for the world that we live in today, or do they think that it's perfectly okay and normal?
I think Justin McLeod at Hinge is honest in his, you know, assuming responsibility for the ethical implications of all of this, because according to Justin McLeod, the CEO of Hinge, he's also interviewed in the film, because before the film came out, before he knew me or, you know, anything, he read the Tinder and the Dating Apocalypse article, and he went to his users and conducted this very broad-based survey and saw that a lot of the things in the article were absolutely true. I mean, you can look up the Hinge survey and there's, you know, 81% of people have never found a long-term relationship on a swiping app. There's just, you know, big statistics on people have been on a date and someone starts swiping on the date, you know, just like...
Wait, people swipe on a date?
Yeah, like they just like take... I'm telling you, a lot of this rudeness has become very normalized because it's just the way what people do is... Yeah, they swipe on a date or, you know, the harassing messages and all that kind of thing. So he said, hey, look, this isn't right. This isn't good. I don't want to be the head of a company that where people are experiencing these things. This is what I set out to do. So he changed his platform, and now Hinge is different. I don't want to do an advertisement for Hinge. I haven't used it, so I don't know if it's better. I've looked at it, but I don't know if it's actually leading to the outcomes that, people want. But he tried. You know, he addressed it. He got rid of the swipe. He got rid of the swiping. That was his. He and his team decided that that was what we have to do, and now Hinge is different and so forth. But yes, I think that he is one notable exception, I think, to something else, which is that I don't think that the heads of the dating apps really seem to know what to do, or I'm not really sure if they care, because if they did, maybe they would be doing more. I don't know. But if you watch the film, you will see in the the third act of the film, there's a lot of discussion of this. I talked to Jonathan Medin, again, CSO of Tinder, about it. I talked to Mandy Ginsberg, the newly hired CEO of Match Group, which owns many, many, many of these apps. What are you guys doing about this? You know, I've talked to all these young women who say that they're sexually harassed and all of these things that we've been discussing here in this conversation. And also, something I did not know when I did the article, Tinder and the Dawn of the Dating Apocalypse, I did not know how much of a problem dating apps have with sexual violence. I was not aware of that at that time.
I was going to ask you to talk a little bit more about that, about how that.
Did you watch
what you discovered?
Did you watch that part of the film that where?
Yeah. But for the listeners, to tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, we just kept getting. I just kept getting interviews with young women who would say, "Yeah, you know, well, you'll see in the film, things happened to them through encounters that they had on these different apps," and I started researching it. It's not hard to research. It's Googleable. And yeah, these online dating services have a real problem with rape, with sexual assault, and I don't think they're doing enough about it. I took it to them. I tried to get them to, show some responsibility, take responsibility, say what they were going to do about it. Jonathan Medin said that all of this was really weighing on them, and my cameraman, actually the day that we were there, my cameraman and I noticed that they had all of these, you know, boards on the wall, you know, a whiteboard where you write with a marker, where they clearly had, you know, and he filmed them, and I'm not really sure if he was supposed to, but nobody said anything. But anyway, he did, and they had all of this, they clearly had been having a meeting about this very thing, because it said like bad actors and this and that. So they're very aware of it internally, I'm sure. And yet when I said to Jonathan Bedeen, well, I was just going to let him answer the question. I said, well, are you aware of anything bad? I think is exactly what I said. It's not a very sophisticated way of saying it, but I said, are you aware of anything bad that's ever happened to anyone on Tinder? And he said, no one's ever said anything to me, is basically what he says. And then, you know, we run all these articles of like women who have had very, you know, tragic and disturbing outcomes from Tinder dates. So we run them on the screen. So I think that they need to do more. It's a new technology, and it hasn't been, you know, car companies had to address things that were harming people. Cigarette companies did, and they buried that data for a long time. It's a company. It's an industry. And that's another thing that, you know, I really have learned from reading your stuff and other tech, you know, writers who are more on the side of examining this culture, is that these are businesses. They're making money. You know,
a lot of money,
billions. And it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. The dating industry. I sometimes refer to it as big dating. You know, it's big dating now. And I think I read, I'd have to check, but I think I read Tinder made $800 million last year, you know, in revenue or something. And so these companies are making a lot of money. And as you point out in the film, they have this business model where they kind of get you hooked, and then they start charging for these features. And they say, well, you can't swipe anymore unless you pay for this. And you can't, you know, Tinder is $9.99 a month. Tinder Plus, which is their full Monty package, is $9.99 a month for people under 30 and $19.99 a month for people over 30. I read this recently. I mean, I'd have to check, but that's what I read recently. That's a lot for an app, you know?
Yeah.
That's more than Netflix or something. So they're making money, and they have a responsibility to their users that I wouldn't say they're meeting yet. I'm hoping the film will raise this kind of conversation, particularly around sexual violence. You know, we're in the Me Too moment, and we're having this, conversation about, well, let me just finish, about sexual assault.
Yeah.
And sexual assault and harassment. And yet the place where I would wager most women are experiencing sexual harassment in their daily lives is on dating apps.
Well, that was what I was going to say to you is there's such a juxtaposition in what you're saying. You're talking about the fact that, you know, there's all this sexual harassment on these apps. You have all these this whole new culture that has arisen. You have these companies that are playing stupid, like Tinder, about their impact on it. And yet at the same time, you have the Me Too movement. And it's like, aren't those two things coming up against each other? Aren't they kind of bleeding together? And or will they eventually bleed together where the Me Too movement actually does push back on some of these things?
Well, that's what my film is, really, to a large degree, especially in, like I say, the third act of it. That's really what we are addressing and what it's about. And, yeah, the Me Too movement started, it had a name. There was a wave of feminism that was going on that I saw in the girls I was interviewing back even in 2014. But it's really what there was like an explosion of feminist awareness and consciousness and, you know, exchanging all kinds of things online. And this is one of the good things that I see in social media. And there's a young woman in the film who says, I love her. Dylan is our character. And she says, you know, social media is enlightening a lot of women to the fact that, you know, I don't have to put up with your shit and I don't have to be, you know, treated as a sex object for the rest of my life, is I think the way she puts it. And yet here we are on these dating apps, which I would argue objectify and sexualize women to a large degree. It's true that men get swiped on as well. I think it makes everybody shallower to a certain degree, but I don't think you have to be a feminist scholar to see how the male gaze, as it's called, is privileged in this casino game, you know? So there's this whole hot or not aspect to it that doesn't get talked about. There's the sexual harassment that doesn't get talked about enough. And yeah, this is bumping up against the Me Too movement and the Me Too moment. We were already editing by the time Me Too had a name, but this is what this film is really. Is what you just said. It's like the collision of the Me Too moment and dating culture.
So one of the things, and we only have a little time left, but one of the questions I have is there's like all these surveys where people talk about, I think it's 80% of people who use dating apps say they're looking for a serious relationship. But isn't that kind of like someone who's saying, I'm going to quit drinking, and they go get a job as a bartender? It's like, don't people realize it's...
What is that Mark Twain said? I stop smoking cigarettes every morning. I'm bad at quoting people, but you know the quote where like, yeah, people give lip service to giving up their addictions. And I think that this is, again, I really want people to see this part in the film about addiction, because it's really interesting to think about how addicted we get to things and we don't even think about it. I smoked cigarettes in my 20s. And when I look back on it, I think, what the hell were you doing? Because, you know, everybody smoked cigarettes. And at a certain point, you know, it was just like, and we don't really go into like, what's all the messaging that's making me think it's okay to smoke cigarettes? Is it Marlon Brando? Is it Carrie Bradshaw? I don't know. But there I was smoking away, and you could smoke in bars. at a certain point, I realized, you know, I would like to live past the age of whatever, so I got to stop doing this. And these things are addictive. And there's all kinds of marketing that's making me do it. And I just, you come to a point where you sort of confront all that. I think in terms of men, you know, there are women, there's a lot of discussion of women in the film, because I think these apps, you know, there are issues with how women are treated. But there are people who identify in other ways. As I said before, I wanted to have different sexual orientations and gender identities, and I wanted to have a lot of voices, and I hope I've done that well. But I think that, let's just talk about heterosexual men for a minute, because, you know, as you say in the film, these apps were designed by guys, kind of for guys. You know?
Yeah, they're all technology by men for men, not thinking about the repercussions of women.
Right, and Silicon Valley is notably, you know, it's not me saying it. There's numerous articles, books now, Brotopia. You know, it's a sexist industry. It's a sexist culture, and they have to do something about it. And a lot of these, if you look at the pictures of all the CEOs of these companies, which we have in the film, they're all white guys. You know, for the most part, and so I don't see, I think that it's not as if dating apps created sexism or something. That would be a very reductive way of anyone looking at it or looking at my film. But I do think that, you know, trends that are sexist and sexist trends and misogyny that has always existed in courtship to a certain degree are actually exacerbated by these platforms. And at a certain point, you can't actually blame the guys who are using them. Of course, everybody should take personal responsibility for what they're doing. But I think that the way the technology is designed, it kind of, rather than make men, heterosexual men, think about these things, it kind of normalizes, encourages, and promotes these same sort of regrettable things. So We do have some young men in the film who talk very cavalierly about how they use these apps. And there's, you know, there's some fist bumps and there's some sort of gloating about things. And there's some real degrading talk, because I think it's important for people to see that goes on. But in a certain way, you know, like I said, I've interviewed teenagers and young people for more than 20 years. At a certain point, I don't blame them. They're just growing up in this culture. They're being formed by this culture. And they're being formed right now by technology. Their attitudes and behaviors are being influenced and informed by technology.
Well, and the other thing is they don't, you know, you and I can remember a time before these technologies where you would go to meet up with your friends at the mall and you would make a plan to be there at 10 a.m. and that was it. And there was no way to reach them if you couldn't. And you would see someone who was a potential significant other, you know, in school or whatever it was. And that was how you met them, or in college or at a bar or something like that, or even on the street. And there was a conversation or your friend through a friend of a friend. So I think for a lot of these people, this generation, they don't remember that because they didn't live it. And so maybe it'll make a resurgence. Who knows, that people will put their phone down. But I think the problem, as you say, is that these things are so addictive. And I think technology in general is. And this is just another side of this. So, okay, so I have time for one last question. What for you, in all the people you spoke to and, you know, all of the reporting you've done on this topic, what for you was the biggest, like, oh, wow moment that you remember?
For the film, Swiped, in when I was doing the film?
Yeah.
I gotta say, you know, I love all of the characters. We have these really great characters who are just so fresh and funny and alive and talk about... There's a really great moment in the film that I love where a young man talks about... he's gay, so he's talking about how to bag a man on social media 101. And he just goes through the steps of how you get somebody to, you know, notice you. And this is dating off Instagram. The film goes into also not just dating apps, but how the whole entire internet has created a different dating landscape. I think you're the one in the film who says the entire internet is a dating app, you know, because you can like someone's tweets or you can like their Facebook posts or whatever. So there's a lot of things in the film that I love and I think that are really fun to watch and informative and insightful. Wow moment for me was when Jonathan Bedeen started talking about this, I don't want to get it wrong, but I think it's called variable ratio schedule, and how the swipe, which he invented, was based on different classes he took and sociology classes and so forth in college, that it's this idea about rewards and how you get someone to, it was one of those moments where you're sitting there as an interviewer and you're thinking, wow, are you really just, okay, go ahead, say it. Yeah. He's basically admitting that he based the swipe on this, in part on this experiment that B.F. Skinner did involving pigeons. Jeez. And I know we're running out of time, so I'll just leave it at that. But it's basically how you turn pigeons into gamblers. And we went and we found
we live in today.
The controversial and some would say insidious B.F. Skinner, you know, social psychologist whose ideas were all about how to control behavior. And so we had our archival researcher go and look, and he found actual archival footage of this experiment of Skinner standing there with all these cages with pigeons pecking away, trying to get their food. Because the thing is, if you give their food right away when they peck, they get bored. But if you withhold it and you wait for them to give it to them, you know, in a random way, they get really excited and interested, and they keep pecking, 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 swiping, 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 swiping. You never know when you're going to get that match.
So that's terrifying.
So when he started telling me this, I was just sort of like, I mean, he was very open about it, and he was just very, I think he just thought it was interesting to talk about. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not really sure he knew how it sounded, at least how it sounded to me.
Well, I think that for a lot of these, you know, young men that start these things, they don't think about the repercussions. They just think about the exciting fact that they can type something into a screen and onto a keyboard and create a world and that someone uses their world and lives in it. And I think for them, it's they don't think about the repercussions of it. So
that's absolutely that's absolutely one of the most important points that I think you made in the interview that we did. Was you said something like, well, you know, they're like college students when they think of these things. They're still children. They're not thinking about how this is going to affect our entire society, which it has.
Yep. All right. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. This has been really fascinating. The movie, the documentary is called Swiped, Hooking Up in the Digital Age, and it's out on Monday, September 10th on HBO, and you can get it on HBO On Demand and Now and Go and all those other wonderful HBO places. Thank you so much for taking the time today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Nick. And if you watch the film, you can see Nick.
You should watch it just for that very reason, just so you
You're
can
see
me. You're
great in it. I got to tell you, my Thanks. Unofficial focus group, I had these, let me just tell you really quick, I know you got to go, but I had all these young people come in, because I'm 53. So I had all these young people who are like my friends or friends of our editor who's a young guy come in and watch the film periodically. I want to see what they think. And they all love Nick. They're all like, I like that guy. I like what that guy had to say. Yeah.
I don't think shaved for the interview, but thank you very much. I appreciate the props. Nancy, thanks so much, and good luck with the film.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks to my guests this week, Nancy Jo Sales and John Kelly. If you enjoyed this conversation, and I am 100% sure you enjoyed this conversation, if you are still listening to this podcast so far in, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. That's me. And yes, there are a lot of great episodes from Inside the Hive. If you go back to the archives and look, there are a few bad ones, but mostly great ones. You can find all of these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave the greatest review for anything you've ever left in your whole entire life. Swipe right, 5 stars, great A+ rating, would do business with them again while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and I will see you all next week. Dun dun dun.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.